Can scientists finally say this extreme weather event, this storm, that flood, was caused by climate change? Not so fast. Nothing simple about the way the Earth works. The planet's top weather agency, the World Meteorological Organization, set up a special branch that partly looks into this. Dr. Thomas C. Peterson is president of the WMO Commission for Climatology. He's also the principal scientist for the National Climatic Data Center at NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, in Asheville, North Carolina. Dr. Peterson, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, for the past 2 years, you've helped gather up scientists to examine the links between human influences on the climate and the extreme weather events that dominate the news and millions of lives. Can you give us a snapshot of how these studies work?
Yes, I'd be happy to. One of the reasons we created this, it's now an annual supplement, is to foster the growth of the science. Attribution, event attribution science, is a real difficult, you know, kind of cutting edge of our field. Several years ago, we used to say that you can't attribute any single event to climate change or to global warming. And about the time that we got politicians and journalists repeating our mantra that you can't attribute any event to global warming, the science had moved on. So you can, if you look at it in a probabilistic sense. You know, for example, a good analogy is the one of a baseball player who starts taking steroids and then hits 20% more home runs. And if you caught one of his home runs when he was on steroids, you wouldn't know whether that home run was caused by steroids or whether it was one he would have hit, you know, anyway, even if he hadn't taken steroids. But you can say that it was 20% more likely that you caught it because of the steroids. And the same is true with now with event attribution, where we're looking at individual events and seeing how they're changing and what kind of how climate change has either made them more common or less common or no effect on it at all. And there's lots of different techniques involved in this, and it's really an exciting field to be in because there's so many different ideas coming out there and so many different approaches that last year we had 19 different author groups producing analyses, and it was just really exciting to see the different approaches coming in, particularly when they looked at the same event. They generally came out with fairly similar results, but the different events kind of highlighted what we call structural uncertainty, how you look at it, you know, that how the uncertainty is. So that two different groups looking at it, you don't say, well, in a previous issue, one of the results said one event was 62 times more likely to occur now than in pre-industrial times. And now with two, you know, you get a sense of the potential errors associated with that estimate of 62.
Well, 2012, the most recent report, it was a big year for really big weather news. And before we go into some detail, can you just list some of the events that scientists examined for climate change fingerprints?
So we had examination of the drought in the central U.S., examination of heat wave in the eastern U.S., Hurricane Sandy, a really remarkable drop in summertime Arctic sea ice. We looked at heavy rains in northern Europe and drought in the Iberian Peninsula, you know, Spain and Portugal region. We also had a really interesting little event that looked at a cold outbreak in Holland that seemed to be cold enough that they could run this 11-city ice skating race made famous in the, you know, Hans Brinker and the Silver Skates. But they couldn't do it this year, and the question was, did it not get cold enough, or was there something else causing it, or was this climate change? Another examination of a drought in the Horn of Africa, which is, you know, Ethiopia and Somalia and parts of Kenya. Heavy rainfall events in northern China and heavy rainfall events in southern Japan. We also had a heavy rainfall event in New Zealand and two different studies examining heavy rainfall in Australia.
Well, as you noted in the report, scientists picked stories close to their own countries or regions, and I know my listeners will do the same. So I'd like to select extreme weather case studies from the United States, from the United Kingdom, and from Australia before we get to the giant global issue of disappearing Arctic sea ice. So why don't we start with Hurricane Sandy? It was a multi-billion dollar disaster hitting New York and New England in October 2012. Can we say climate change contributed to that storm and the damage?
We can definitely say that climate change contributed to the damage that Hurricane Sandy caused. After Sandy hit, we scoured the scientific community, contacting lots of potential people who might work on analysis of attribution of Sandy. And most of the people we contacted either said that they weren't going to be working on it, or that, you know, because it was just too complex, or sure, we'd love to do one, but our results won't be available for 3 years. But we did find one group that isolated one aspect of it, and that's sea level rise, how, you know, the global warming is causing the seas to rise through the melting of glaciers, melting of ice mass on Greenland, and also through the warming of the water because, you know, as things warm, they expand. So the water's expanding as it, the ocean water is expanding as it's warming. And what impact that has made on the change in the probability of having an event like Sandy, inundation like Sandy. It turns out that the sea level rise is only a minor part of the Hurricane Sandy event, but that little minor part, when you're looking way at the tail of the distribution of such a rare event, can change whether Hurricane Sandy is a 1,500-year return period or a 200-year return period event. And then we get into what does it imply for the future as sea level continues to rise, and it could become a much more common event, you know, like a 100 or even a 50-year event as sea level continues to rise. And this is the kind of information that I think is real helpful for people when they're rebuilding. They need to know, I mean, if this was a 1,000-year event and you're not expecting it to come back again for another 1,000 years, or I have a probability of not returning for 1,000 years, then you might rebuild along the coast just the same way you had before. But if you can see clear information that shows that these kind of events are becoming more likely and that high inundation levels are likely to occur again and more frequently, then you realize that, well, when you know, if you rebuild your house, you build it up on stilts, you build it higher, you do something different so that you're not as vulnerable as you were before.
Dr. Peterson, let's look at another extreme happening in America that same year, and I'm talking about the 2012 drought that hit the U.S. central states in the east. How bad was it?
Oh, the drought was really serious for the people involved in it. It had a lot of hardship for the farmers and the individuals involved. And the study that examined it was a really interesting study in that what they did was they took sea surface temperature patterns that we have. They took the actual sea surface temperature and ran a model on it and saw whether we would get a drought or not. And then they took the sea surface temperature patterns and kept the patterns, but they cooled the sea surface temperature down to pre-industrial times. And they used a climate model that also had pre-industrial levels of CO2, and they ran the two models out. But when you're looking at changes in the far distribution of the tail, you need to run a model out hundreds and hundreds of times to get a reliable estimate of some of the extreme events that might occur. And the resources in this group was not available to own a supercomputer. So what they did was it was citizen scientist participation. They have this model that is now simplified enough that it can run on a home personal computer, and they have volunteers around the world who allow them to run their model on their computer at night when they're not using it. And then when the model is finished, it sends in results. So they had hundreds and hundreds of model results from this to compare from the model using the observed sea surface temperature and including the patterns in the temperature and the observed carbon dioxide and the pre-industrial levels of carbon dioxide and pre-industrial temperatures, but with the sea surface temperature pattern. And what they found was that the drought was just as likely, or almost just as likely, within the pre-industrial conditions as the current conditions. So their conclusion was that this drought was not enhanced by global warming, but it was a function of the sea surface temperature patterns helping produce circulation patterns that fuel the drought in the central U.S. And that also then is relevant for farmers who are planning and who need to know that, you know, is a drought like this likely to happen again next year? Is it likely to become worse? And this particular event, this particular analysis said no, that it wasn't.
Let's move across the pond, as they say in Britain. In 2012, the UK and much of Northern Europe experienced a drenching wet summer, even while Spain dried up and burned. What did teams of scientists conclude about the climate and the wet European summer of 2012?
This was interesting because we had several groups looking at it in several different approaches. And one of the approaches looked at this particular condition using global ocean temperatures and how they impact the circulation. And then they would substitute in climatology. So they substituted in climatology for the world ocean except the North Atlantic. And then the world ocean except the climatology for most of the Atlantic Ocean, but just not the region close to Europe. And what they found was that this event is very heavily dependent on the actual sea surface temperatures up in the far northern Atlantic Ocean. The Atlantic Ocean was really warm at the time, but they did not do the additional step further along to analyze and determine what caused the North Atlantic to be so warm. But what they did were able to attribute was that the rainfall was directly related to the very warm ocean temperatures in the far North Atlantic, which then also has potential to help for forecasting and seasonal forecasts. If sea surface temperature patterns set up again like that, you can expect, you know, more heavy rainfall in parts of Northern Europe.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm your host, Alex Smith. We're talking about the growing trend of extreme weather events with one of the world's leading specialists, Dr. Thomas Peterson, from the World Meteorological Organization and the American agency NOAA. Well, as you know, Thomas Peterson, scientists don't always agree. One paper asked a question on many minds, namely, are recent wet northwestern European summers a response to sea ice retreat? And that group, led by scientist F.B. Simon, said there was no evidence the Arctic meltback affected the summer rains. And I thought to myself, well, that kind of contradicts studies of jet stream changes and sea ice done by Dr. Jennifer Francis of Rutgers. What's going on there?
It is interesting, the changes in the sea ice. They've been remarkable in the Arctic. And one of the things that happens when you have an ocean covered with ice, that it prevents a lot of heat from the ocean being released into the atmosphere. And when you remove that ice, the water will evaporate. And, you know, the moisture in the air is what fuels storms and stuff. So you have a potential to alter circulation around the world when you have another heat source in it. Indeed, you know, part of El Nino is when you get this warm water in the eastern tropical Pacific Ocean, and that releases a lot of heat into the atmosphere from that area, and it affects circulation patterns. So one of the things that's clear is that when you have a change in where the source of energy is coming in parts of the atmosphere, that you'll get different results, different weather patterns forming. And different scientists and analysis show that different types of events, depends on the type of rigor and the analysis of a particular event, or whether it shows if you open up the Arctic Ocean in different times of year, you know, how that'll impact circulation in different ways.
It seems like the authors of the various papers on the Arctic sea ice had difficulty saying that the September low of 2012, which was an absolute record low, was about half of what we would have expected in previous decades, that it was caused by climate change in particular. Why are they having those doubts about what seems quite obvious to the rest of us?
So in the beginning of attribution of climate change, we had detection and attribution. Could you detect a change? And the first big change people looked at was global temperature average. Global average temperature was warming. You could detect a significant change in that. And then could you attribute it to warming? And the answer was yes. And then you started doing that on other things, like heavy precipitation in general, heavier precipitation during the days. And people have worked on Arctic sea ice. So we see this decrease in Arctic sea ice. And can you attribute that to climate change? And the answer is yes. But when you get to an individual year, you have other factors going in. Why was this year below the trend line? Or in this case, it was 2012 below the trend line. And 2013 was actually above the trend line. So why did it drop down so much? There were several different reasons about it. One was the general warming of the Arctic. One was that so much melting has occurred in past years that the ice was thinner, because two-year ice is about twice as thick as ice that only formed in one winter. And another factor was that in 2012, there was one particular storm that really churned up and broke up a lot of sea ice in a very short time, and it was a very powerful storm over the sea ice edge. So you have to factor all of those in to get a determine of whether what you can say the causes were of this particular event being below the trend line. But you can still understand that the trend line is due to long-term warming.
2012 was also a tumultuous year for Australia. Like many other parts of the world, there were extreme precipitation events in the northern part of that country with floods and high costs to the economy and human lives. Was that an example of climate change?
That is what I think most people expected when they were starting to analyze it. And one of the model results shows that with climate change, Australia should expect to have some heavier precipitation events. And by heavier, they're talking like perhaps a 10 to 15% increase in the heavy rainfall events. But the rainfall that occurred then was so extreme and so far beyond above the 10 or 15% that the two analyses that were looked at it determined that, no, it was not a climate change of caused by climate change. It was caused by sea surface temperature patterns and the circulation involved in that. That, you know, we know that when we get an El Nino event and there's warming in the eastern tropical Pacific, Southern California gets heavier rainfall events. Well, when you get warming in the Pacific Ocean, you get less rainfall in Australia. The rain goes somewhere. The circulation changes. And there's been a lot of strong La Niñas lately and a lot of energy in the water off the coast of Australia in various areas. And it was determined by those two events that it was not long-term climate change that caused the heavy precipitation. Interesting, this last year in Australia was record warm year for Australia. And one of the groups that analyzed the heavy precipitation last year and concluded that it was not due to global warming is analyzing the temperature this year to see what can be concluded by that. And I expect that they will have different results, but we shall have to wait to see for sure until next year's report is released in September of 2014.
It seems to me from reading the papers, Dr. Peterson, that several scientists felt frustrated by climate models not reflecting what they knew was happening on the ground. For example, the Chinese scientists studying very extreme rains and flooding in northern China in 2012 said they couldn't assign the role of climate change due to problems with the CMIP5 climate models that when they were applied to that region. Do we still have this limitation of trying to peer through things with regional modeling?
We still have a lot of limitations, and there are lots of different models available that people are using, and the scientists working on them, you know, have different areas of focus that they work on, and some of the models have biases relative to other models. So, for example, I've heard that the Canadian model tends to dry the central part of continents more than some of the other models. So when you look at a model, you'd first want to make sure that that particular model does a good job in your area. And it's, you know, it should not be surprising that, for example, the UK Met Office model does an excellent job of simulating the climate of the UK. And so first want to make sure the model can reproduce the climate of your area before you try to find out how it can alter whether the climate is changing enough. And China also has been having some really interesting and dynamic changes in their climate, both in terms of the events of the previous year, but also in terms of the influx of atmospheric pollution from China and trying to understand how much of that is causing, you know, what problems and how you can pull out the different signals and stuff. And so it's a difficult challenge to understand fully.
Right. The industrial smog, a lot of particulates in the atmosphere, that could change things too. I wanted to ask you, who is paying close attention to the extreme weather reports of the American Meteorological Society and conferences like the one held in Oxford University in September of 2012? What sort of people are really focusing in on this?
One of the most interesting groups of people, there were a couple people at the meeting in Oxford from the reinsurance industry. So when you get insurance, say from State Farm or something like that, you know, from your local insurance agent in Florida, those insurance companies often hedge their bets by getting insurance upon that insurance so that they won't be devastated if a hurricane hits their area. They will have the resources to cover that. So the reinsurance industry is really, really keenly interested in understanding how extreme events are changing. And how extreme events are changing is going to impact, you know, what they charge, because they're looking at competitive, because they're different companies, so they each are trying to get the best information they can, because they don't want to overcharge or they'll lose business, but they don't want to undercharge or they'll lose a lot of money when extreme events happen. And one of the interesting things is when we talk about attribution to extreme events, how things change, a lot of the way people change their behavior is actually the insurance company is leading the way on that. That, you know, you're not going to build your house unless you're independently wealthy. You're not going to build your house in a low-lying coastal area that an insurance company is going to refuse to provide insurance for. You're not going to be able to get a mortgage if the insurance company won't insure in your area. So insurance companies actually have a lot of influence on future building and construction and how people are decreasing the vulnerability to extreme events.
Thomas, in the wrap-up for the report you helped edit, there's an example of driving too fast as a parable for trying to measure climate risks with our science. Talk to us about that.
Okay, I'd be happy to. So this analogy is one that we borrowed from UCAR out in Boulder. And they have an analogy that as we know that if you increase the speed of your commute, that you're more likely to get into an accident. But when you do get into an accident, it often isn't because you were going 5 miles faster. It was because there was a texting driver next to you on a slick road who swerved into your lane or something like that. Now, if you were driving a little bit slower, you might have been able to avoid it. But the actual cause of the accident might be the texting driver. And that analogy works well in climate change, that, and we're looking at an event attribution, that we know that adding CO2 to the atmosphere, some people have referred to as kind of the steroids of the atmosphere, that there's more energy, more potential for some extreme events to occur. That's like a driver going a little bit faster. But when an event actually does occur, there's so many other factors going in that you have to understand in order to cause it. Was it how much of it was due to that the texting driver and how much of it was due to your faster speed? And that gives you a sense of the challenge that the scientists face in trying to understand this for individual extreme events. And one of the exciting things we have looking forward to next to the edition that will be coming out looking at 2013 is we have a large number of scientists, an increasing number of scientists, interested in giving us analyses of extreme events. And so the growth of this area of science is increasing.
Dr. Peterson, I really appreciate your work and especially giving up your valuable time to talk with us. And I hope you persist for many years until the science does really grasp and be able to tell us what's coming up. Thank you for talking with us.
Thank you.
I'm Alex Smith, and I've been talking with one of the world's top experts on extreme weather events, Dr. Thomas C. Peterson. He's the principal scientist at NOAA, and he's also the president of the World Meteorological Commission for Climatology. This is Radio EcoShock. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm your host, Alex Smith. Get all our previous programs at our website, ecoshock.org.